I too want to welcome the visitors. Welcome Martins and Tim Walls with us. And it's good to see everybody here. There's probably others I missed, but welcome. It's been a little while since I had a break from preaching for a while, and it was pretty nice. And I guess it's time for me to get back in the groove again. Anyway, thank you, Joe, and the others for he filled in for me a couple Sundays ago. What to preach on? What to preach on? I think that's what every preacher wonders sometimes. It seems like some know better than others. Some of us, it's a bit more of a struggle. So you get to hear what I've been studying in my devotions. A little bit like Laban laid out this morning, how he shared what he has been studying. And I appreciated that. And I was also amazed at how much the Sunday school lesson lined up with what I want to share this morning. And then some of what Joe was saying also. We're going to get around to reading about Joseph in Genesis 40 eventually. But the title of the message this morning is God's Desire for My Complete Trust. God's Desire for My Complete Trust. Why is it that trusting God, an all-knowing God, can be a problem for me? Why is that? Why is it that I like to think I'm in control of my own destiny? And why do I sometimes find it easier to look at my friends or my church family, and it's easy to trust them? It's almost easier to rely on their opinions and their recommendations more than what I want to trust God sometime. Why can't I not simply completely have a childlike trust in God? My children amaze me sometimes in the way that they are. I know they're pretty young yet, but their complete trust in their parents' ability to take care of them. Sometimes you wake up and you look at this family you have in your house and you realize you're responsible for them, and it kind of scares you a little bit. And yet they wake up and they come out of bed and there's food there for them to eat, and they just trust you. Why can I not trust God like that? I tend to look with awe at some of the old patriarchs in the Bible. We talk about Job and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Daniel and Paul and some of these men that just seem to have an unwavering trust in God. And how did they do it? How did they do it? God asks what seems, in my mind, some of these almost perfect humans to completely trust him, and he gave them some real challenges. He gave them some tough stuff to go through. Think about Isaac being, or Abraham offering Isaac. That was tough. And I tend to think that, well, they were those people. It was Abraham. But you know what? Abraham, he was a human like you. He was a dad like a lot of you dads. He loved his son. How could he trust God like this? And so I see God asking for, it seems like, large amounts of trust out of some of these old patriarchs. And yet, I consider, here I am trying to micromanage every little detail in my life like I don't trust God. What's wrong with me? And I understand that we live in America today. We're very blessed living here in America. I know what capitalism almost seems to, or this American capitalism almost seems to take place sometimes of people needing God. We're a long cry from, I read a book a while back of some children in North Korea. We don't know what it's like as parents to count out rice grains on our children's plates because we're trying to equally divide the meal. We don't know what that's like. We don't know what it's like to be in Israel or Gaza or Ukraine this morning and wondering if a bomb's going to fall on our house. We don't know what that's like. I have no idea what that is like. So it seems almost childish to say that we have to, not childish, but it seems like those people are the ones that have to trust God. We don't have to because we're an American, we're safe. Let me tell you, that is a wrong concept, and I hope to share with you a little more about that. And another thing I want to mention here at the beginning is, if you hear me say in this message that we need to only trust God and never trust people, you misunderstood the message. We have to trust people. Everything in this world moves at the speed of trust. I'm not saying never trust man. I'm just saying don't ever let your trust of man trump your trust of God. Because if you do, you're going to wake up on dangerous, shaky ground. We need to remember that all these blessings in this life truly do come from God. They really do. The history pages are full of people all throughout history that put their complete trust in man, and then when life smacked them around, they really found out the hard way. You think about the Bernie Madoffs and there's a bunch of crooks out there that conned people into trusting them and then majorly let them down. And we like to look at them and say it was the Bernie Madoffs and the whatever that other man's name is that just went to jail, Sam something or other, that went to jail for ripping off a bunch of people. We like to say it's out there. But it comes into our plain circles too. It does. There's some Anabaptist men sitting in jail right now for conning people out of money. People that happily ripped off folks just like you and me. It's not just out there. And once again, I'm not saying never trust others around us. And we don't need to be highly scrutinizing and highly suspicious of everybody. Just don't let that trust in man trump your trust of God. So I have already been, it feels good to be trusted, doesn't it? As a man or a lady, we want people to trust us. I know in my life already, I have already been very trusted. As a young man, I was probably, 18 or 19 years old. I had an acquaintance of mine that I didn't even know that good, but he had a Corvette. And he let me drive it all by myself. Just sent me down the road in it, which was probably pretty foolish on his part. But I remember I couldn't believe it that this man let me drive his Corvette. I still remember that he trusted me to do that. I also remember another man who I was given a sum of, he was supposed to pay me to give the money to somebody else, and it wasn't even that much money, but it was a little wad of cash. And he pretty much completely did not trust me. And I remember how that felt. I remember he was calling the people where the cash was supposed to go to, making sure it actually came. And I would have kind of liked to be the person to answer the phone and pretend that I never came in just to scare him for a little bit. But that didn't work out. But I know what that feeling was like. I don't like to not be trusted. And most of us, we're sitting in here this morning, we're pretty blessed folks at how much we can actually trust each other. Nearly anybody sitting in this building, I would feel comfortable if I bought a very expensive vehicle in another state and the buyer wanted cash or whatever and one of y'all wanted to go get it. I'd hand you the cash and I would be pretty trusting of that. I'm blessed in that way. Not everybody has a circle of people like that around them. Thank God for people like that. So we have these people in our lives we trust. Now let's suppose you woke up tomorrow morning and you didn't have any of these people. What would you do? If you didn't have your trust in God and everybody you trusted was suddenly out of your life, what would you do? And we say, well, that's about impossible. it is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but it's happened, and it happened to Joseph. In Genesis 40, let's look at Joseph. He woke up in prison, or he was sold, and he woke up in prison. And all he had was God left. This man, Joseph, seemed to be made of almost supernatural material in my human mind. Joseph was an amazing man. Seemed like, so let's just do a little backstory on Joseph before we read some of this in Genesis 40. Seemed like he was, we would call him today the child that was born with the golden spoon in his mouth. He was a, by all accounts, a good-looking chap and a boy that his father singled out as his favorite. He wasn't perfect, and we'll touch on some of that. But he was an amazing individual. So he was son number 11 out of 12. And going back even further, we remember how Jacob got tricked by his father-in-law, named Laban. He thought he was working for Rachel, and whore of whores, he woke up and he found it was Leah. And he had to work another 7 years for Rachel. For this man named Laban that was not known as a very honest man. He really wasn't. He was not a man you really wanted to pattern your life after. We know how Jacob grew his flocks and his wealth from Laban. We find that in Genesis 30 by taking some of the spotted cows and what he did with the strips of wood there. And I don't understand how that all works, but it's kind of interesting. And out of that, he grew his herds. Pretty amazing. Laban was also known to have idols in his house, which his daughter Rachel would have stole from him. So Joseph had these 10 older brothers. They were his half-brothers, not from his father's favorite wife. And we have I have the names wrote down here, but I don't know if I can pronounce all of them. But there was 10 of them. And then along comes Joseph and Benjamin, and they were the sons of Rachel. Rachel died in childbirth with Benjamin. But let's go back to his 10 older brothers for just a little bit. These 10 older brothers were not what you think of as wimpy men. They were not wimpy men. They were strong men. And so I've been going through the story of Joseph. And just if y'all will bear with me for a little bit, I've been having an interesting time of it, because I'll read the story in here, and then I'll go read the account out of the Apocrypha. And the Apocrypha, it gives some very interesting details that the Bible leaves out. So some of this, what I get out of this message today, came from the Apocrypha, I'll just be honest with you. And I tried to only try to use it where it actually lines up with Scripture, and it does. The story of Joseph lines up very well in the Apocrypha with the story in Genesis here. The Apocrypha would state that, so going back into Genesis 34, you remember the city of Shechem. We remember what happened there with their sister Diana, and how one of the princes took her. Then he fell madly in love with her, and he tried to buy her, and they refused to sell her. And Joseph's sons, these 10 sons, came up with the idea that if all the men in the city get circumcised, all right, they'll sell him. All the men said, all right, we'll do it. And then these two sons, Simon and Levi, went in 2 days later and just wiped the whole city out. And the Apocrypha gives a pretty good description of how that all happened. And then also the fear that it put into Jacob. Because Jacob said, now everybody in the country is going to hate me. You made me to stink before the inhabitants of the country. You'll find that in Genesis. And according to the Apocrypha, the Bible's silent on it, but according to the Apocrypha, there was a lot of war that the Bible's silent about, of these cities that ganged up on Jacob and his sons due to what these two sons of his did to the city of Shechem. And it talks a lot about how these 10 sons of Jacob completely wiped out all these cities around them. And it was nothing short of a miracle of God. It was a complete miracle of God the way everything happened. And it's just very interesting. Y'all should read it if you haven't already. Anyway, I tell you all that to tell you that all this happened, and then along comes Joseph and Benjamin. So all the hard work's been done. All the bloodiness, the war, the destroying of the cities, all this is done, and along comes Joseph and Benjamin. The older sons set the stage for an easy life for the two younger. And so you have this Joseph coming along, and he's living in luxury as his father's favorite son in a land that they nearly died for. And then he starts having these dreams, and he comes telling his brothers about it. Of course they're going to be a little bit aggravated at him, right? Who wants to do all the hard work and then have little brother come along and reap all the rewards and then brag about it? And the Apocrypha would actually say that Jacob rebuked Joseph and basically told him to hush up about his dreams in front of his brothers. And then chapter 37, we have when they took him and they threw him in the pit. It seems he changed hands twice. I'm not sure how that all laid out, but somehow through the Ishmaelites and the Midianites, and then the Midianites ended up selling him to Potiphar. There's some trading around there. And then he makes it to a palace where the important people hang out in Egypt. And he does his work well, and he prospers, as Joseph does. And then we have the account where he has this horrible run-in with his master's wife. And the Bible is very clear that that was a tough encounter. And the Apocrypha is even more clear on it. It gives a few more details on that. I have no doubt that this Potiphar's wife was a very beautiful lady. I have no doubt about that. The kings weren't really known to pick anything other than what they considered the very best. And the temptations Joseph went through there, and the fact that he was able to remain strong in it and go to jail for it, for something he didn't do, that's amazing. That's amazing. And he was there for 10 years, and that brings us to chapter 40. So let's read here in chapter 40. I don't think I'll read the whole chapter. Let's just read... Let's start in verse 5. And they dreamed a dream, both of them. This is talking about the butler and the baker here. They dreamed a dream, both of them, each man his dream in one night, each man according to the interpretation of his dream, the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, which were bound in prison. And Joseph came in unto them in the morning and looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. And he asked Pharaoh's officers that were with him in the ward of the Lord's house, saying, "Wherefore look ye so sad today?" They said unto him, "We have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it." And Joseph said unto them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, I pray you." And the chief butler told his dreams to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream, behold, a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches, and it was as though it budded, and her blossoms shot forth, and the clusters therefore brought forth ripe grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and gave the cup to Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said unto him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thine head and restore thee into thy place, and thou shalt deliver Pharaoh's cup into his hand after the former manner when thou wast butler. But think on me, and it shall be well with thee, and show kindness, I pray thee, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also have I done nothing that they should put me into this dungeon. Then the chief butler saw that the interpretation was good, and he said to Joseph, I also was in a dream, and behold, I had three white baskets on my head. The uppermost basket there was of all manner of baked meats for Pharaoh, and the birds did eat them out of the basket upon my head. And Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation thereof. The three baskets are 3 days, yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thy head from off thee, and shall hang thee on a tree, and the birds shall eat thy flesh from off thee. And it came to pass the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast unto all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief butler and the chief baker among his servants. And he restored the chief butler unto his butlership again, and gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. And he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. And yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. Just an interesting little side note. So we didn't read the first verse, but it talks about it just calls them the butler and the baker that offended the Lord, their Lord, the king of Egypt. And then verse 2 states that Pharaoh was wroth against the chief of the butlers and against the chief of the bakers. So it almost seems like these two men, Pharaoh got angry at their bosses for letting the workers become slack on the job. Just an interesting side note. The Apocrypha would also state the reason Pharaoh was mad because his wine had flies in it and his bread had nitre in it, which is basically like a stone, I guess. Who knows, they might have gave Pharaoh a real toothache. But we have these two men and their dreams. And I like the heart Joseph has for these two men in verse 6. He looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. I get a picture of a caring man, even in jail. He apparently had a heart for people. So in verse 14, we hear Joseph complain about as much as he ever complains. It's about as sad as we hear him talk about his situation. But here, and you may be wondering by now, what does this have to do with trusting in God? And here's the verse that stuck out to me, the Apocrypha, that made all this come to mind. So I knew Joseph was in jail for 10 years or whatever. And then he was in for another 2. He was in there for 10 with this butler and baker, and then 2 after the one got executed and the one got restored. But here's what I read about trust. And listen to this verse out of the Apocrypha. And the butler to whom Joseph had interpreted forgot Joseph and did not mention him to the king as he had promised. For this thing was from the Lord in order to punish Joseph because he trusted man. So if the Apocrypha is right on that, Joseph got to spend another 2 years in jail because he had put his trust into man. For a brief moment in his life almost, it feels like he decided, I'm putting my trust in man to get me out of here. God's not getting it done, and so I'm gonna move on with this. I'm gonna ask man to do it. And here's a man that's going free. I interpreted his dream. I'm going to be right. He's going to be right in front of the king. I'm going to have him plead my case in front of the king. I'm going to have him ask the king for a pardon, basically. And it almost makes you wonder. I thought, as I read that, I thought, really, God? Joseph is one of the men that seems to have more trust in you than anybody. I mean, he came out of prosperity and his father's favorite son. He was sold by his mean brothers. He was tossed in a pit. He was traded around like an animal. He trusted you and went through the whole deal with Potiphar's wife. He got thrown in jail for 10 years. And then just because he trusted in man for a little bit, you're going to make him sit in there for another 2 years? Really? But God in his all-knowing ways is perfect, and he knows exactly what he's doing. One thing, and the thing that hit me, is that God longs for me and your complete trust. He really does. He longs for you to completely trust in him like a child. And he longs for me to do that. And I mentioned before, we're living in America, so what does that have to do with it? I mean, we know what we're having for lunch. We don't have to trust God that we're going to have food for lunch. Some of the women, you women meal plan for weeks in advance. We know what we're going to have. So what does trusting God actually mean in America today? What does it actually mean? I was reminded of that man that had meetings, Sim Yoder. I forget exactly the words he used, but something along the line of, we have to know God for who he is. We have to know God for who he is. And that's the first point that I have here is, when I understand that God is the creator of everything, and someday you're going to stand in front of him and I'm going to stand in front of him, and there's no getting away from that, and we are going to give an account, it makes me understand that we do need him and his son Jesus desperately every single day of our lives. It doesn't matter that we might not have quite the day-to-day trust for material supplies like some people do in poor countries. Although that does come from him every day. But when we understand that we are going to stand before God, we're going to give an account someday, and it's only through the blood of his son Jesus that we're going to be able to spend eternity with God. When we know that, it makes you understand we got nowhere else to place our trust. Absolutely not. And we like to think that this time that we're gonna have to stand in front of God someday. But it's, who knows when? It could be 50 years. It could be this afternoon, folks. It could be this afternoon. We need God more than ever. And point number two is, know who you are in comparison to God. Man gets all kinds of funny ideas. They try to do all the kinds of things to get away from God and their responsibility to him. They don't want to give account to an all-knowing God someday. They try to live forever. They've tried that for, yeah. It's not going to work. Some try cremation to get away from him. Some try to get together and comfort each other that there is no God so they don't have to worry about giving an account. And they're wrong, and if they don't change their ways, they're sadly going to find out too late. But when I realize I'm a fumbling human compared to an all-knowing God that created this world, it kind of makes you understand how Job was able to say in Job 13:15, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Job knew it was his only hope. And Job was a wealthy man. He was a very wealthy man. Yet he still knew where his hope and his trust needed to be. So what's some things, and I still do. And one of them, the thing, I'm past this now, but I used to struggle with the thought of, what if I die and I leave my wife with a bunch of debt, mortgage on the house or whatever? Why couldn't I trust that to God more than I did? I thank God I'm past that now, but that was a real fear of mine. It was. Why couldn't I trust that to God? Another thing I struggle with right now is this. So we got these outreach questionnaires out, and I'm a man that doesn't like change. I don't really care for change, and I don't know what the church is going to decide on that, but I've struggled with that already. I've wanted to live my life here in Strawberry, Arkansas. I'm happy here. I have a good job. It's comfortable. I don't want to move. Can I trust that to God? No matter what God decides, if God decides to ship me off somewhere, Can I leave it with him and trust him? If he decides to, I'm going to stay here, can I trust him with that? And if he decides there's no outreach at all, can I trust him with that? Can I believe that no matter what happens, it's going to be all right? I know some people struggle with health, or they have, some people were born with health issues. One of my fears was, what if I get paralyzed and I'm a vegetable and I'm a burden to everybody for the rest of my life? I know that's probably not going to happen, but it's crossed my mind already. Can I trust God that he's got the best in mind for me? And one thing about Joseph that I found, it's very obvious, the man put he did everything he could. And I think we here also need to do everything we can. I think we need to work and do everything we can with our abilities to take care of our family, to take care of whatever. But at the end of it all, I'd better realize all I can do is all I can do, and there's a lot of loose ends that I'm going to have to trust God for, no matter what it is. And we can't do foolish things. Don't go take out 6 car payments and $1 million mortgage when you make $50,000 a year and then sit back in your easy chair and say, boy, this is going to be interesting to see how God's going to provide. I'm just going to trust him to do this. We don't do things like that. You have to use your head. But there is some things we need to be very, very trusting, very open to God. I know some people really struggle with assurance of salvation. I can't say it's been a big struggle of mine, but it has. I have struggled in that already. Go read 1 John 1:9. Go read that. If God says he is faithful and just to forgive us if we confess, well, then believe it. Believe it. He said it, and if we've done everything we can to make it right, we don't need to struggle with assurance of salvation. I don't need to struggle with it. Don't let the devil discourage you in that. In closing here, do all you can. This was a quote from some president, and I attacked a little bit on the end. Do all you can with what you got, where you are, and then realize that's hopelessly inadequate and leave the rest to God. If I can do that, I'll live a much more peaceful, fear-free life. I really will. 2 Corinthians 9:8 in closing says, "And God is able to make all grace abound toward you always, having sufficiency in all things, and may abound to every good work." That kind of sounds like a God of abundance to me that deserves my trust. And if I can just do what I can and let God take care of the rest, that would be my encouragement to y'all this week, the rest of the day, the rest of your life. Do what you can and let God take care of the rest. Let's kneel for prayer.